Okay, and since I'm the last speaker in this wonderful day, I think it falls to me to make sure that we thank Alisa for all her hard work and the people who helped her organising. It's been a great day. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, so we've heard about a little bit about how Du Châtelet, how her text underwent some revisions as it came up to publication, and that's what I want to talk about today. So the text, as it was going to press, underwent enormous revision. She suddenly started making a lot of changes to the text, and the question I want to ask is, why did she start making these serious revisions to her text? What was it she was trying to achieve that led her to reach beyond the resources of the Newtonian? So we've seen in several talks today, there's a lot of material in this text that is not standard Newtonian material. So why did she think that she needed that? What was she trying to do? And I think that the key to this is the role of Du Châtelet's account of scientific method in her foundations. So what I'm going to argue today is that the way that we should read the text is as beginning with the problem of scientific methodology, and secondly, that the revisions that she made are first and foremost revisions to the account of scientific methodology, that these revisions to the account were introduced by Du Châtelet in order to address what was for her the single most important unsolved problem arising in physics at the time. And so this very much complements the kinds of things that Andrew wanted to say about how we should understand the material that's in the text. I think that it is in addressing this problem by means of the new method that she introduces in the revisions to the text that leads her to introduce all these new metaphysical commitments, the so-called sort of Leibnizian and Wolffian elements. And that it's really helpful in thinking about her text to think about her scientific methodology, because I think this not only frames the project of the foundations by being what she's talking about in the opening chapters, it also unifies that project. We can see this method at work throughout the text. So those are the things I'm going to try and persuade you of in our last session today. So let's start with the problem of scientific methodology. So at the beginning of her text, in the preface, she starts by situating her text first as a pedagogical text directed towards her son. She situates it as being directed towards the current state of knowledge in physics. And then thirdly, she situates it in the context of the existing literature. But having done that, she then introduces the issue of methodology, and all the rest of the preface is about this topic. And we get kind of the main features. She starts by warning us about the dangers of using hypotheses incorrectly. She talks about the importance of experience and experiment in guiding our reasoning, and she introduces Leibniz's principle of sufficient reason as a guide to our reasoning. So let's have a look at this in a little bit more detail. So here's what she says already in the preface about the dangers of hypotheses. She says, it is true that hypotheses become the poison of philosophy when they are made to pass for truth. An ingenious and bold hypothesis, which has some initial probability, leads human pride to believe it. The mind applauds itself for having found these subtle principles and next uses all its sagacity to defend them. Most great men who have made systems provide us with examples of this failing. These are great ships carried by the currents. They make the most beautiful maneuvers in the world, but the current carries them away. So the problem then is how to make use of hypotheses. How is our use of hypotheses to be constrained and regulated? How are we not going to get carried away by them? And the answer that she offers us is a two-pronged scientific methodology. So hypotheses are to be constrained on the one hand by the principles of our knowledge, and on the other hand by experience and experiment. And these two aspects of the methodology are what she gives us in chapter 1 and chapter 4. So now I want to say a little bit more about what's in these two chapters. And many people here will be familiar with this, but I think it's important to get this out explicitly. So chapter 1 then is of the principles of our knowledge. So it's about how we can know things. Whenever she's talking about it, it's always about our knowledge. And already in the first paragraph, in the very beginning of this chapter, she says, it's very important to be attentive to principles and the manner in which truths result from them if one does not want to go astray. So the problem to be solved then is, how are we to proceed in order to achieve knowledge and avoid error? What's the method? By what method are we going to achieve this? And then she goes on to explicitly reject Descartes' method of clear and distinct ideas. She says that leads to fables and reveries and to perpetual disputes. We need something else. Instead, what we should adopt, she says, is the principle of contradiction and the principle of sufficient reason. These are the two most important principles of our knowledge. So the way that she introduces them is she introduces PSR as a constraint on our reasoning. And this is her main emphasis when she's talking about PSR. She says, for the source of the majority of false reasoning is forgetting sufficient reason. And you will soon see that this principle is the only thread that could guide us in these labyrinths of human error the human mind has built for itself in order to have the pleasure of going astray. So we should accept nothing that violates this fundamental axiom. It keeps a tight rein on the imagination, which often falls into error as soon as it is not restrained by the rules of strict reasoning. And then also in this methodological role for PSR, within that general umbrella, she thinks of causes. So she says a cause is good only insofar as it satisfies the principle of sufficient reasoning. And this is important for her. So her causal understanding, causes falling under her understanding of PSR, is related to her version of the law of continuity, which she thinks follows as a corollary of PSR. And then this law of continuity plays a crucial role throughout the foundations. And already she's using it to argue for things in chapter one. So she uses the law of continuity as a constraint on physical theorizing, saying all, so she argues that all changes in motion are continuous. There are no perfectly hard bodies. And she argues using this that Descartes' rules of collision are erroneous. So what I'm trying to convey here is that the primary role for PSR in the foundations is as a component of her scientific methodology. PSR is introduced as a guide to our reasoning, and it's used in practice in chapter one, and I want to say throughout the foundations, as a guide to our reasoning. Okay, so that's the first prong of this two-prong scientific methodology. So now let's have a look at the other prong, which is in chapter four, which is this famous chapter on hypotheses. So this chapter begins by saying the Cartesians admit too many hypotheses, the Newtonians admit too few, and what we need to do instead is to admit hypotheses into science. So it's an important part of what we're trying to do in science, but we need to adopt much stronger criteria for assessing them. So here's what she says. She says, without doubt, there are rules to follow and pitfalls to be avoided in hypotheses. The first is that it not be in contradiction with the principle of sufficient reason, nor with any principles that are the foundations of our knowledge. And it's this first thing that she's already dealt with in detail in chapter one. She's told us how we're supposed to fulfill that first requirement on constraining our use of hypotheses already in chapter one. Now she turns to the second half of the methodology. She says the second rule is to have certain knowledge of the facts that are within our reach, and to know all the circumstances attendant upon the phenomena we want to explain. This care must precede any hypothesis invented to explain it, for he who would hazard a hypothesis without this precaution would run the risk of seeing his explanation overthrown by new facts that he had neglected to find out about. Okay, so she then goes on to spell out some details of how we should use experience and experiment to constrain our use of hypotheses, and I just want to put a few features of this in front of you. So she emphasizes exploring the empirical consequences of a theory and not merely seeking consistency with prior observations. She says, if it is found that these experiments confirm it and that it not only explains the phenomenon that one had proposed to explain with it, but also all the consequences drawn from it agree with observations, its probability grows to such a point that we cannot refuse our assent to it. She also emphasizes the asymmetry between acceptance and rejection. We saw this earlier. One experiment is not enough for a hypothesis to be accepted, but a single one suffices to reject it when it is contrary to it. And then in terminology, you know, the way we might put it today in contemporary terminology, she also talks about selective falsification. She says, thus in making a hypothesis, one must deduce all the consequences that can legitimately be deduced, and next compare them with experiment. If there is a single one contrary to them, either the entire hypothesis must be rejected if the consequence follows from the entire hypothesis, or that part of the hypothesis from which it necessarily follows. And then another thing she says is that there should be no ad hoc modifications. So it is necessary that the phenomenon result necessarily without obligation to make new suppositions. When the necessary consequences do not follow from it, and to explain the phenomenon, a new hypothesis must be created in order to use the first, this hypothesis is only a fiction unworthy of a philosopher. So I've just highlighted some of the passages. It's an entire chapter. It's a very rich treatment of the use of hypotheses in scientific theorizing. We heard some more about it earlier, and then there's some references up there. Also, as came up in Andrew's talk, some of de Châtelet's institutions appears in the Encyclopedia of Diderot and D'Alembert, and large portions of this chapter on hypotheses is one of the most of the biggest entries. So specifically, it's those sections. You might wonder, well, then how come we don't know that it was de Châtelet who wrote this stuff? So there are some oddities in the citation. And then Anne Sewell, who's part of the group who've been working on this at Notre Dame, she has a draft paper where she looked through and found some more entries that are due to de Châtelet, that most of them got in there by this chap Forme. And she's looked at the route by which these entries ended up in there. And you can see from the citation that you wouldn't necessarily know that it was de Châtelet who did the hypotheses chapter. It says Voyer des Institutions de Physique, but there's other texts that have that name. It doesn't say de Châtelet, and it gets the chapter wrong. And it also references someone else as well. So these are the ways in which people disappear out of history. All that to one side. For my purposes, the crucial point is that de Châtelet is offering a detailed account of how it is that we use empirical evidence as a constraint on scientific theorizing. So what I've been trying to convey fairly quickly, admittedly, but to try and get across to you, is that de Châtelet advocates a scientific methodology according to which scientific theorizing is to be constrained from two directions, from the principles of our knowledge on the one hand, and from experience and experiment on the other. And this is the focus of the early chapters of her Foundations of Physics. The focus is scientific methodology, first and foremost. So rather than thinking about these as the metaphysical chapters, at least when we first come to these chapters, we should be thinking about them in terms of method. So I also want to say that this is exactly what we should expect from a Newtonian text. This is what they look like. And just to try and make that vivid, let's have a look at some other texts. So we know that de Châtelet worked closely with Voltaire on his Elements of Newton's Philosophy, and that her book, we were hearing earlier, how her book grew out of her involvement in this work. And if we look at that book, and if we look at the introduction to that book, we'll see that Voltaire recommends Scrafzandi, Kyle, Muschenbroek, and Pemberton. And each of these books, these sort of standard Newtonian references, they begin with a discussion of philosophical method. So lecture one of Kyle's book is of the method of philosophizing. Aside, I think this is really important for the future trajectory of Newton's books. This is prior to the second edition and third edition of the Principia, so it's prior to the Rules of Reasoning getting their prominence that they have. But anyway, so lecture one of Kyle's, of the method of philosophizing. Scrafzandi, chapter one, of the scope of natural philosophy and the rules of philosophizing. Muschenbroek, chapter one, concerning philosophy and the rules of philosophizing. Pemberton, introduction concerning Sir Isaac Newton's method of reasoning in philosophy. So for de Châtelet to have begun her text in the same way, by thinking about a method, by saying something about method, would have been completely standard. Go a little further into this. Each of these discussions includes Newton's rules of philosophizing. So chapter one of Scrafzandi ends by stating Newton's first three laws of philosophizing. Muschenbroek ends also with stating them and having a discussion each of them. Pemberton's introduction concludes with all four of Newton's rules of philosophizing. And by the third edition of Kyle's book that started out as lectures that he gave in Oxford, we've got the three rules in there. They're discussed. They're not discussed in the first chapter, but they're there in lecture eight. We know also that de Châtelet had Newton's rules of philosophizing, or at least the third rule anyway, in the original manuscript version of chapter one of her institutions. So originally that chapter, that's right at the beginning where I'm saying we should be thinking of this as a methodological chapter, had Newton's rules of reasoning in it. So I think that helps towards the evidence. What else then is in these introductory methodological chapters? Well, the four Newtonian texts include in these discussions of method, in these early chapters, discuss our epistemological limitations. They discuss the hazards of hypothesis and conjecture. They discuss the dependence of the laws on the will of God, the epistemic limits of our inquiry that terminate with the arbitrary will of God, and the desire to avoid error. Du Châtelet's early chapters contain all of these themes, as well as others that can be found in the text. So there's also arguments from design, questions about the epistemic status of essences, yes, Andrew, and so on. So I want to say then that, I haven't said anything about these chapter 2 and chapter 3. At least chapter 1 and chapter 4, I think clearly the first way that we should come at them is thinking about them in terms of methodology. And I think chapter 2 and chapter 3 should also be read in that key to start with. And so I was very happy with Andrew's talk and with Judith's talk, which I think speak very much to this, that chapter 2, one of the themes that's going through this chapter, as I said at the end of Andrew's talk in the Q&A, it includes when and where it's legitimate and illegitimate to appeal to God in explanations. And then, so I really like very much Andrew's talk and his discussion of what role chapter 3 is playing and why it's there with respect to what Du Châtelet is trying to do later in the text. But I would want to give a more general account that of why that chapter's needed. We need to have consistency with the demands placed on scientific explanation that we get out of chapter 1 and chapter 2 when we're looking at essence, attributes, and modes. And also, I think, crucially for her, and this is a special case of applying, this would be the case of universal gravitation. She's trying to give an account of causal action between things in the world and to give us the resources to do that in terms of essence, attribute, and mode. So I think that's part of why that's there. She's trying to give us the resources for the kinds of explanations that we're going to want to give later in the text. So I think those chapters can be, although I said that very fast, I think can be pulled into the same story. They're not oddities, they're part of the methodological setup. But anyway, the overall point that I'm trying to get across is that methodological considerations are the standard starting point in the Newtonian textbooks that Du Châtelet read, and that we should think of the early chapters of the foundations as being primarily concerned with scientific methodology. Okay, so that was the first thing that I was trying to persuade you of. Now I want to say that the revisions that she makes to these early chapters are first and foremost revisions of the account of scientific methodology, and that the way to see that is because these revisions were introduced by Du Châtelet in order to address this problem that I said for her was the most important unsolved problem arising in physics at the time. So what problem would that be? And some of you in this room know me very well, so you know exactly what problem it's going to be. So Du Châtelet, I think, found a method that enabled her to address the problem of bodies. So this is the question of, okay, we've got this thing, physics, it's got these laws, or in both Descartes and in Newton, that take as their subject matter bodies. Well, okay then, what are these bodies that are the subject matter of the laws? And the thought is that a complete physics ought to be able to answer this question. It ought to be able to tell us what its subject matter is. But by the time Du Châtelet's writing, it's becoming clear that this being able to give an answer to this question is more problematic than it might have seemed at the outset. And there are two aspects of this problem, I think, Du Châtelet was particularly interested in. She was interested in how can there be extended bodies? So how can the bodies are supposed to be extended? How is that possible? But how are they extended? And also, how is it possible for bodies to act on one another? And both of these are standard Newtonian topics. So the extension of bodies involves divisibility and cohesion of bodies. Thinking about the agency of bodies involves thinking about inertia, thinking about the transfer of motion or of force, or just about forces in general. Involves thinking about collisions, hardness, elasticity. So we would expect her to be thinking about these things in relation to this problem that she has about, well, yeah, what are the bodies that are the subject matter of physics? And I think initially, if we look at her early writing and her letters and things, we can see that in keeping with other Newtonians, Du Châtelet ended up appealing to God to solve the problem of how such bodies are possible. So Here she is on the question of how extended bodies are possible. So she's writing to Mopatry here, who she corresponded with a lot as she's trying to figure out things to do with physics. She says, your idea that God did not make a body without elasticity gave me an idea about this. It is that the first particles of matter can be indivisible not by the total privation of elasticity, but by the will of God. For we are often obligated to resort to him, and I believe this indivisibility of the first bodies of matter to be an indispensable necessity in physics. So in the end, we're going to have to appeal to God to answer that question. Same with the question of how is it possible for bodies to act on one another. So here's what she's writing, and this is right at the end of the manuscript version, so maybe 1738, something like that. In the end, it seems to me that this is no easier to conceive the simple communication of movement between bodies, supposed to be completely hard, than to know what their forces will be after the collision. One must, I think, leave both questions to God. And then the simplest case of them, is that of one body that hits an immovable obstacle. And this case is subject to the greatest difficulties. I'm quite afraid that we must resort to God for the collisions of bodies. So she's not alone in this. It's a fairly standard Newtonian position. Here's perhaps the extreme case of it, but I'll give you the quote from Wishenbrook. Anyway, we do not understand the manner of operating of any one thing. All we can do is to observe the effects that constantly flow thence. When two bodies impinge against one another, how do they operate upon each other? What is the force, and how is it transferred one to the other? All these mysteries are concealed from us mortals. So she's not alone in thinking that in the end we have to appeal to God, but she doesn't like it. She's not happy about appealing to God in order to solve what to her seems a crucial problem in order for us to have a physics that makes, in order to get the project of physics off the ground, surely we ought to be able to say what the subject matter is, what our physics is about. And she's particularly worried about appealing to God in the solution of the problem of bodies, because she's worried that it ends up leaving us with bodies that don't have genuine causal agency. And she expresses this worry in the published version of the Foundations with respect to the Cartesian picture, where she's worried that you end up with occasionalism, and she doesn't like that. And secondly, and I think this is sort of a special case of the general problem of bodies being able to act on one another, but it's particularly pressing for Duchatelet, is that it leaves the problem of human agency a mystery. And I think this was really, for her, the most pressing issue of all. And again, this came up earlier today in Judith's talk. So we've seen this quote before, but I will read it through again. But the only thing that puzzles me at present is liberty. For in the end, I believe myself free, and I do not know if this quantity of force, which is always the same in the universe, does not destroy liberty. Initiating motion, is that not to produce in nature a force that did not exist? Now, if we have not the power to begin motion, we are not free. I beg you to enlighten me on this point. So we have the sort of general problem of bodies as the subject matter of physics, but this very particular problem that she has. We want bodies that can act on one another, and in particular, I want to be able to act. If I'm a free agent, then I need to be able to act in the world. How is that going to be possible? We need an account of bodies that allows for human free action. We know that Duchatelet intended a chapter on liberty to be part of the original version of the Foundations of Physics. It didn't end up in there in the end, but there's clear evidence that it was intended to be in there. And she begins that chapter by saying the question of liberty is the most interesting that we can examine, because we can say that on this sole question, all of morality depends. And she continues to be worried about that. She's got a really interesting account, I think, of human liberty, where there are two components that she thinks need to be met. So on the one hand, she has a rationalist conception of freedom of the will. So we have to act on the basis of reasons, and the better the reasons, the more free we are. So very much in line, we know that she'd read the Leibniz-Clark correspondence, very much in line with the Leibnizian picture, but that's not enough to be free. You need this other component as well. You need to be physically capable of self-motion. So there's a kind of voluntarist thing that she's combining with it. So we need these two things. We need freedom of the will in the sense of the rashness conception and then being able to initiate motion. And this is what she says: the physical power to act is thus what makes a man a free being. So God is free in the sense of the rashness conception, but we're a different kind of creature. We're human beings. We have embodied in the world, and the true and sole liberty is thus the power to do what we have chosen to do, and requires us to be able to act bodily in the world. So all of that is just to say that she was worried about this question of how is it possible for bodies to act on one another, and it was particularly worrying for her because she was worried about human agency. So how are we going to solve this problem then? It seems as though just appealing to God is not enough. It doesn't show us that bodily action is possible in the world. What are we going to do? Here is Pemberton making the methodological challenge clear. It is only here required to steer a just course between the conjectural method of proceeding, against which I have so largely spoke, it's just done that, and demanding rigorous proof, as we reduce all philosophy to mere scepticism and exclude all prospect of making any progress in the knowledge of nature. So we don't want to just freely hypothesize, we don't want to only have sort of deductive proof, we've got to be able to do something in the method in the middle. How do we do that? For the Newtonians, it was supposed to be Newton's rules of philosophizing that were going to guide us in this, but for Du Châtelet, these just weren't good enough. They were insufficient for addressing the problems that she was most concerned with, in particular, the problem of bodies. So now turn our attention to the published version of the Foundations, and this is where Du Châtelet offered her solution. She says, here's what we're supposed to do. So the experience and experiment, on the one hand, have to guide us in this rich way that she was describing, but we also have to be constrained by the principles of our knowledge. We need both if we're going to be able to solve these problems. So this resulted in a change to her text. Changes to her text. So on the topic of method, the most obvious places are that Newton's rules of reasoning disappear from the opening chapters, and instead we get Leibniz's principles of contradiction and sufficient reason. She'd known about these for a long time. Why do they only suddenly come in now? Why are they suddenly, she realizing she's got a method now? So I think this is where thinking about the Wolf text and probably her conversations with Koenig are important. She suddenly realized this can help me solve the problem of bodies, of the subject matter of physics. So the chapter on hypotheses, chapter 4, gets a small but I think very important update. So here's the manuscript version. This paragraph begins the same. Without doubt, there are rules to follow and pitfalls to be avoided in hypotheses. We saw that already. Then, if you don't have the first, we go straight to the second prong of the method. We need to take care to have certain knowledge of the facts and of all the circumstances attendant upon the phenomena we want to explain. The published version, we get the first prong introduced. So now we've got both sides of the method. So, my claim is that the revisions to the early chapters of the Foundations are first and foremost revisions to the account of philosophy, and that they were made because she saw that this new method enabled her to solve the problems that she was particularly worried about. And in particular, she was now able to solve the problem of bodies without having to appeal to God. There's no appeal to God anymore in her account of how extended bodies possible. That's what she addresses in chapter 7. And in chapter 8, she explains how it's possible for bodies to act on one another. So those two chapters now address these two aspects of the problem of bodies that she was worried about, and they do so without any appeal to God. So she says, with respect to extended bodies, it's by this dissimilarity that one can understand how non-extended beings can form extended beings. An aggregate of simple beings must be extended. And we heard earlier today a bit how that goes in terms of how it's to do with how we experience diversity. And then on the nature of bodies, she says, all the changes that happen in bodies can be explained by these three principles: extension, resisting force, and active force. The nature of bodies consists in them. Well, that's very brief, doesn't really tell you how she answers the question. The main point is, as we've heard a lot about today, that addressing the problem with the new method involved her introducing a lot of new metaphysics. And you might think, oh, this is too much metaphysics, but For her, this is where it led her. In order to be able to address these problems that she took to be very important, she ended up introducing all the metaphysics that we now see in the early chapters of the Foundations. So that's the claim, that it's in addressing the problem of bodies, which she took to be a problem that physics itself ought to be able to address, in addressing that problem by means of this new method, that she ends up introducing the new metaphysical commitments that we see that certainly go beyond the Newtonian. So she's going beyond them in terms of the methodology and also in terms of the resources that she feels she needs to draw on in order to address the question that she takes to be important. So how does it go? Just to emphasize that she is using both aspects of the methodology in these later chapters when she's addressing these questions. When she's addressing how extended bodies possible, she appeals to PSR to say that we need to introduce non-extended simples, so they have to come in at this point in order for her to give an account of how extended bodies are possible. And then when she's talking about how it's possible for bodies to act on one another, again, it's an argument from PSR. She's appealing to PSR in order to argue for the essence of body not being merely extension, but also having to include active and passive force. So we end up with this whole complicated theory of forces that I don't understand, including the primitive force of non-extended symbols, all this kind of stuff in her account of the agency of bodies. So we do get a lot of metaphysics going on, but what I want to say is this is just as much metaphysics and no more than is needed to address the problem of bodies by this method. So it's not that she's, this sort of relates back to what I was worried about with Marius's talk in a way, is that we shouldn't be looking for to provide this whole complete metaphysics. We should be thinking, what problem was she trying to solve? Does she have enough in order to be able to address that, given the questions that she has? Okay, so I think we did that. Last thing then, to try and kind of say, yeah, it's really all about method. It's not that the text is all about that, but thinking about scientific method can really help us in how we understand the text, how we approach the text. So it's not just that the text begins from the problem of method and is framed in that way, but it also unifies the text. We can see her use of her method running all the way through the text. So it tells us why she has the metaphysics that she does. It ties the metaphysics to the needs of the physics, and it enables her to treat not only the problem of bodies that I've been emphasizing, but also two additional problems that were important, she thought, and controversial. So Newtonian universal gravitation versus vortex theory and the vis viva controversy, both of which we've heard a bit about already. So I want to end just by talking a bit about how the method, the two-prong method, she puts it to work in these two cases that she took to be important. Okay, so the issue is Newtonian universal gravitation versus vortex gravitation, and the question is, how do we decide between these theories? If we make use of her method, then we do it by appealing to empirical evidence and by using the principles of our knowledge and seeing if together they will uniquely tell us which, or at least decide for us between those two theories. And this is exactly what she does. So in chapter 15, she looks in detail at planetary trajectories, and she concludes that there's insufficient evidence to decide between the two theories. She then turns her attention to the shape of the Earth, and this is what she locates as being the crucial place for being able to decide between vortex theories and Newtonian action at distance theory, or Newtonian particle-to-particle universal gravitation. And there she concludes that at the time, the empirical evidence is favoring Newton. So she has this long-standing interest in the things that George was telling us the later history about, later, that she continues to be interested in. She thinks this is where we're going to be able to decide, where this is where we should be looking to try to decide between these different approaches to gravitation. In the next chapter, in chapter 16, she argues against Newtonian universal gravitation on the basis of PSR. So she's already told us, she already argued for the plenum in chapter 5, using PSR and the law of continuity. And then in chapter 16, she draws on those resources and argues against Newtonian gravitation. So we've got this unfortunate outcome that the empirical evidence favours Newtonian gravitation, whereas the principles of our knowledge favour vortex theory. So what should we do? Well, she does exactly what she ought to do given that outcome for her method. It's inconclusive where we've got to. And she says, she ends the chapter by saying, perhaps a time will come when we will explain in detail the directions, movements, and combinations of fluids that operate the phenomena that the Newtonians explain by attraction, and that is an investigation with which the physicians must occupy themselves. So she's not going to say, you know, we've got to go with vortex theory. She's not going to say we've got to go with Newtonian theory, but she is going to say what these two different options are going to have to do in order to overcome the other one. So despite the inconclusive situation at the time she's writing, the method is demonstrating its power for driving theorizing forwards by focusing our attention on what we would need to do in order to meet both the demands of the principles of our knowledge and the empirical demands. So that's the universal gravitation case, undecided at the time that she's writing. What about the vis viva case? And so we heard earlier about how she brings this controversy back to life. And the issue is, how are we supposed to decide whether dead force or living force is the correct measure of the motive force of bodies? And again, if we're going to apply the method, what we're going to do is we're going to appeal to the principles of our knowledge and to empirical evidence and see whether we can decide between hypotheses on this basis. And this is exactly what she does. So chapter one, we're now at the last chapter of the foundations of physics. So this method that we started talking about in the preface, it's run all the way through the chapters that we're talking about. We're at the last chapter. The revised version of this chapter begins with PSR and proceeds to theorize dead and living forces within this constraint on theorizing, to try and figure out to the extent to which we can talk about these two forces in terms of PSR, and to argue for living force as the measure of the force of bodies. Having done that, she then turns her attention to the empirical evidence, and that's the second half of chapter one. So she explores the empirical consequences of the hypothesis, the force of a body is proportional to time on the one hand or space on the other, and ends up concluding in favour of living force. So this time, we have a much happier immediate outcome, that both elements of the methodology lead to the same conclusion. And Du Châtelet concludes accordingly. She says, we've seen in this chapter that all experiments concur in proving that there are living forces, and metaphysics speaks almost as strongly in their favour as physics. So here's the upshot. And so what I'm trying to kind of persuade you of is that this is a way to read the text that I think is helpful in terms of understanding what it was that she was trying to do and why she does the things that she does at the different places in the text, because her treatment of scientific methodology is not only the thing that starts the text, as it did for the Newtonians, but it plays a really deep role in unifying what she does in the later chapters of the text. So these were the things that I tried to persuade you of, that the foundations begins with the problem of scientific methodology, and it's not surprising that it did, because she was just kind of following the pattern that was out there of the text that she was reading. But she found that method to be unsatisfactory, so the revisions are first and foremost revisions to that account of scientific methodology that were introduced in order to address this problem that she took to be really crucial at the time, the problem of bodies. And it's in addressing that by means of the new method that we get all this metaphysics being drawn into the project. Once she's got the new method in place, then it not only frames the project, as I was just saying, but also unifies it. So that's the resources by which I try to answer this question of why she made such serious revisions to her text, and what she was trying to achieve that leaves us with this published version that looks so different from the Newtonian text of the time. So my answer is that she found this new method that enabled her to address what were for her the most pressing and controversial problems facing physics at the time: the problem of bodies, gravitation, and vis viva, and this is what drove the changes. Thank you.